The final chapter of the unit is about photosynthesis. And I want you to keep in mind what we've already covered when we started cellular respiration, well, started the previous chapter, which is that there is a reciprocal relationship between photosynthesis and the complete oxidation of glucose. So now, with a better understanding, hopefully, of the complete oxidation of glucose, photosynthesis will make, or the reciprocal relationship that I mentioned earlier will make more sense. Photosynthesis is not the reverse of the complete oxidation of glucose, meaning that it takes a different path compared to the reverse of it. But remember that we can summarize either one of these two processes, either photosynthesis or the complete oxidation of glucose, with a single reaction. It's a summary reaction because it doesn't happen in one step, but the summary reaction tells us the beginning and the ending, right? And so the way photosynthesis happens stepwise is not the reverse of the complete oxidation of glucose, but the summary reaction for photosynthesis, pretending that it does happen in one step, in other words, is exactly the reverse. All right? So what are the inputs into the complete oxidation of glucose as a summary reaction? Those are the inputs into glycolysis. That's true. I mean, you're right for that, but I'm talking about the entire process. What is the summary reaction for the complete oxidation of glucose? No, the summary reaction, the one-step reaction that pretends the complete oxidation of glucose happens in one step. What do you need on the left side of the equation for the complete oxidation of glucose? Oxygen. What else? Glucose, yes. Glucose and oxygen, and specifically, stoichiometrically, you have to balance this thing. So what is glucose? Okay. And you said oxygen. Well, we need six of those. Become what? Six of each of those, six CO2s and six waters. That will balance. Okay? Now, that's the materials. You also, as a product, have energy, which is why you're bothering to do this, right? After all, you're burning fuel for the purpose of putting that energy into the form of ATP. We've just learned in the previous chapter that it doesn't happen in one step, right? This is a summary reaction. It takes a long path going through all those steps. Well, photosynthesis is the reciprocal process, which means if you pretend that photosynthesis happens in one step, you can summarize it with a reaction that is the exact reverse of this. For photosynthesis to happen, you have to put in energy, form of sunlight. You have to give the photosynthetic organism water and carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide is the carbon source, the inorganic carbon source that it's going to use to make organic compounds out of. And through the many steps of photosynthesis, what it will spit out is oxygen and organic compounds, including glucose. So it's exactly the reverse if you summarize these things in one step. But the many steps in the pathway for the complete oxidation of glucose is one way to get from here to there. Photosynthesis takes a different way back, basically. So it's not actually the reverse. It's just summarized as the reverse. You see what I'm saying there? Okay, well, in the first slide, we just have some pictures of photosynthetic organisms. We're most familiar with plants. I mean, most people think of plants first. That's partly because we are terrestrial organisms, so we tend to think only about what's in our immediate surroundings. But keep in mind, though, that for most of the history of life on Earth, there was no life on land. That's kind of a recent thing. No plants existed until fairly recently. About the same animals and plants are about the same age, as a matter of fact. But life started in the ocean, and that's where photosynthesis started as well. Bacteria invented photosynthesis, just like bacteria invented the complete oxidation of glucose. They invented cellular respiration, right? We talked about the fact that mitochondria came into existence by a cell engulfing a bacterium that was a respiring organism, and it survived that process. What am I talking about? What hypothesis is that? What do we call the situation in which something lives in something else? Endosymbiosis is the general. Yeah, so the endosymbiotic theory tells us that bacteria were the original source of mitochondria, and bacteria, different kinds of bacteria, were also the original source for chloroplasts. Chloroplasts were just engulfed bacteria that survived, and those bacteria happened to be photosynthetic. So photosynthesis started in bacteria. Now, of course, bacteria are prokaryotes, and so they don't have membrane-bounded organelles. They don't have chloroplasts, but they are able to accomplish the same thing that plants and other photosynthetic eukaryotes do with their chloroplasts, even though bacteria have only one membrane. That's because they fold their membrane back and forth many times, so it's almost like it's a separate compartment. There are plenty of eukaryotic organisms, though, that are photosynthetic, of course, including plants. But do you remember what I said the name is for any eukaryotic organism that is not an animal, plant, or a fungus? What is that group called? Called a protist. So not all protists are photosynthetic, but many of them are. And a word that we give to any protist, therefore not a plant, animal, fungus, or prokaryote, that is photosynthetic is an alga. So there's different kinds of algae, like brown algae, green algae, red algae. Those are photosynthetic protists. Some of them are multicellular, some of them are unicellular. But there's all kinds of photosynthetic organisms nowadays. We're going to focus on plants, starting in slide 2 and for the rest of the chapter, even though in the other photosynthetic organisms, the process occurs basically the same way. We're going to view it, though, from the viewpoint of plants. And in a typical plant, the greenest part of the organism are the leaves. The leaves for a typical plant are the primary photosynthetic organs. Now, there's plenty of exceptions, including plenty of exceptions right around here, because we live in a desert that features a lot of cacti, and cacti change their leaves by evolution into totally different organs. They don't. The leaves on cacti are not photosynthetic at all. They've evolved into spines that protect the plant. Instead, what would normally be the stem is the green part of the cactus. That is any part that is green is capable of photosynthesis. But in most plants, it's the leaves that do most of that job. And a typical leaf, a flat structure, is kind of like a sandwich. where the pieces of bread, so to speak, top and bottom, are layers of epidermal cells, just like our skin, basically. And the filling of the sandwich is primarily these green cells that you see here that are called mesophyll cells. Mesophyll cells individually, like the one you're looking at here, contain many chloroplasts. Typical cell, mesophyll cell, will have about 50 chloroplasts in it. This is just one cell. And whether it's in a leaf or not, though, any cell that has chloroplast is capable of photosynthesis. Before we leave this sandwich, though, notice that the bottom view here, it's also true of the top, you just don't see both pieces. This epidermis, every here and there, is perforated by little holes called stomata. That's the plural of stoma, which means mouth or opening. It's not a structure, it is just the space. But the space is either open or closed depending on the two cells that surround the space. Those are called guard cells. And they can swell or shrink to either open or close the stoma. The rest of the epidermis, though, is pretty well sealed. So it's waterproof and gasproof, which means the plant can control whether gases can pass through these stomata. And you see CO2 and O2 being exchanged here. Water vapor also goes in and out. But CO2 is coming in, notice, because this is the reverse process. This is the reciprocal process. CO2 is not waste. CO2 is the requirement, right? Here we're looking at the summary reaction for photosynthesis would be going this way. You have to give the photosynthetic organism carbon in inorganic form so that it can perform the very important thing that photosynthesis does, which is to use that carbon to form organic compounds. And what is that process called? What is incorporation of an inorganic carbon into organic form called? Any idea?
Decarbonation.
No? Carbon fixation. Yes, carbon fixation. That is the big deal about photosynthesis. Only producers are able to do this. All of the consumers rely on all of the producers to do that for them. We wouldn't exist without that. Okay, let's just quickly recall the basic anatomy. We went through this in a different chapter, but in an individual chloroplast is just like a nucleus or a mitochondrion, a multiply membrane-bounded organ now. So there's an outer membrane, an inner membrane. And the inner membrane is actually continuous with the thylakoid membrane in green, but we give it three different names. Outer membrane, inner membrane, and thylakoid membrane. And this cutaway view shows you that even though these look like individual little sacs, each one of them is called a thylakoid, there really are, their lumen is continuous with each other. So it's all one chamber called the thylakoid space. There's three compartments in a chloroplast. The thylakoid space is inside the thylakoids, which are stacked into grana. That's the plural of granum. One stack is a granum. Outside of the thylakoids, but still inside this inner membrane, is the stroma. It's a different compartment. And be careful with that word, because it's very similar to stoma, which is totally different. And then you also have a compartment between the outer and inner membranes called, once again, the intermembrane space, just like it is for the mitochondria. These are not only different spaces, they contain fluid that's chemically different from the other chambers, just like in a mitochondria. Okay, let's go on to the process now. Slide 3 shows you the inputs and outputs for photosynthesis. It's not exactly what I wrote, though, because notice that there's water on the top and on the bottom. The top here is the left side of the reaction, inputs, reactants. the bottom is the products, the right side. Well, it is true that water is involved on both sides, but you can simplify this. Since there's water, 12 waters required and 6 waters that are produced, we simplify it simply by subtracting 6 waters out from both sides. That's why I have 6 on here and none on the other side. But the main point of this way that these arrows are drawn is to show you the fate of these individual atoms. For instance, you've already been taught that photosynthesis produces oxygen, and you might have thought, well, that oxygen comes from the carbon dioxide that the plant takes in. But notice that that's not true. The oxygen in the CO2 gets incorporated into the fuel that it produces. The oxygen that it produces as a byproduct comes from water, the other required component as an input. Now think about the process we just went through in the previous chapter. Complete oxidation of glucose is this happening in reverse. And why did we need oxygen? As a final electron acceptor, right? And it's not just electrons that the oxygen that we breathe accepts. It also accepts protons. And that's why oxygen that we breathe turns into water. Well, this is just the reverse of that. Water is required as an electron source, not as an electron acceptor. And that requires splitting this thing into hydrogens and oxygen. That's where the oxygen comes from. It's just left over. Really, what the plant is trying to get are the electrons in the hydrogen of that water. Okay. Let's look at 4 now. This is a one-slide summary of photosynthesis. And it looks similar to the summary it's arranged similarly to the slide that summarizes the complete oxidation of glucose, except that every part of photosynthesis occurs within its organelle. Remember that for the complete oxidation of glucose, glycolysis happens just in the cytosol, right? That's part of the process. And then only the second major phase, which is cellular respiration, occurs in the mitochondrion. Well, there is no part of photosynthesis that occurs out in the cytosol. It occurs entirely within the chloroplast. But there are also, as you can see here, and kind of in column form, 2 major parts of photosynthesis. Photosynthesis is the overall process, but the 2 parts have had different names over the years. This book is calling part 1 the light reactions and part 2 the Calvin cycle. Well, in the old days, these two parts of photosynthesis were called the light reactions and the dark reactions. And they eventually figured out that that was probably not a good idea to call them that, because when you call something the dark reactions, it kind of implies that darkness is required for them. But that's not true. The light reactions are best called, in most modern textbooks we'll call it, the light-dependent reactions, unambiguously stating that light is required, right, for the light-dependent reactions. And the Calvin cycle can also be called the light-independent reactions. So those are the 2 best names for the 2 parts of photosynthesis, light-dependent reactions and light-independent reactions. Calling it the light-independent reactions lets you know that that part can happen whether there's light or not. Light isn't directly involved. All right, now I said that the big trick of photosynthesis is the carbon fixation part. That's really the most important part, right? That's what qualifies that thing as a producer. And that actually occurs in the second part of photosynthesis. The Calvin cycle, light-independent reactions, is where carbon in inorganic form, carbon dioxide, becomes incorporated into carbon in organic form. Sugars, which can be made into glucose and other things, and not just sugars. Once you have, sugars are what are produced, actually a three-carbon sugar, as we'll see. That's what gets produced directly by photosynthesis. But once you have organic compounds, they can be transformed into other organic compounds. So it's not just sugars that you can make out of this stuff. You can rearrange it into all the other organic compounds that the organism needs. But that happens in the second part of photosynthesis. Well, using one of the three pairs of antonyms that we talked about, how would you describe carbon fixation? How would you describe the production of sugars using CO2 as a source? No, not both. Which is, because those are opposites. No. Anabolic builds things up, right? What you're doing is making a more complex thing out of a less complex thing. Sugar is more complex than CO2. So that's why it's anabolic, right? Well, in terms of energy, what word would you use? What corresponds to anabolic?
Endergonic
is the opposite of it's the opposite of exergonic. It corresponds to anabolic. Exergonic corresponds to catabolic. That's what we talked about in the last chapter, right? The complete oxidation of glucose is catabolic. You're breaking down the fuel, but you're doing that because it's exergonic. That's the way you get the energy out of it. Here we're in the reciprocal process. You're building up fuel rather than dismantling it. That's anabolic and therefore is endergonic. You have to put in energy to do that. Well, the energy input, of course, is sunlight. But a plant does not use energy of sunlight directly to fix carbon. Just like we don't use the energy released from our fuels directly to drive our endergonic processes. What do we use instead? Or what the hell am I talking about when I say we don't use it directly? Yes, ATP is the middleman, the energetic middleman. We can't drive our endergonic processes directly with the energy released from breaking down our fuels. So we have to release the energy by breaking down our fuels to produce ATP, and then use that ATP to drive the endergonic reactions. Similarly, a plant can't directly use sunlight to drive the production of the sugar out of CO2. It needs an energetic middleman. Actually, two energetic middlemen. ATP is one of them. And it shouldn't surprise you that ATP is a requirement for this second step, because we just got done saying that it's an endergonic process, right, to build a sugar. It's endergonic and anabolic, so it should require ATP or some source of energy. That's one of the sources of energy that's required, though. ATP by itself won't get the job done. You have to supply this second part of photosynthesis with two different energy-carrying molecules, ATP and NADPH. Now, we haven't talked about NADPH yet, but you might have already guessed that it's very similar to NADH, which we have talked a lot about, right? NADH is which form of a taxi? Okay, what other word besides full taxi? It's the reduced form. It's the high energy form. Well, that's NAD, nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide. NADP is very similar. It's just like it, except it has a phosphate on it as well. That's the P part. But this is also an energy-carrying taxi, but it's a different fleet. A plant, remember, is doing both of these processes, not just one. It's doing the complete oxidation of glucose, and it's doing photosynthesis. It has mitochondria for cellular respiration. It has chloroplasts for photosynthesis. We just have mitochondria, so we're doing the one process. A plant's doing both. But anyway, it has two separate fleets of taxis. It's like two different companies working in the same town, two taxi companies. The NAD fleet is for cellular respiration. It has a separate fleet of taxis, though, NADP, that it uses for the same purpose, but in photosynthesis. And just like NAD plus gets reduced into NADH, NH plus, NADP plus is the oxidized form, and it gets reduced into NADPH, NH plus. All right, so it's doing exactly the same job. It's just doing it for photosynthesis instead of for cellular respiration. Anyway, these are the two energetic requirements. These are chemical energy inputs, right? The original input is light energy, which is not material. That's not chemical energy. That's radiant energy. The plant can't use light energy directly in this process. It needs these two chemical energy sources, ATP and NADPH, to do the job. Well, that's the whole reason that you need part one of photosynthesis, to generate these two chemical energy carriers. The light-dependent reactions can capture the energy of sunlight and put it into the form of ATP and NADPH and H+. All right, so that's why ATP and NADPH is coming out of the light reactions. That's the direct product of the light reactions. But that feeds into the Calvin cycle or the light independent reactions so that the sugars can be made using CO2. Water, of course, is the other chemical input. You have CO2. If you look at this reverse reaction, CO2 coming in and water coming in. As I said in the previous slide, the water is really a source for electrons, but specifically the hydrogens in that water are the source of the electrons, and getting at those requires splitting that water apart. The hydrogens are really the valuable part, that's what has the usable electrons, and then what's left over is oxygen. From the viewpoint of photosynthesis, it is simply a waste material. Of course, that oxygen can be used by the same plant in the same cell by mitochondria that it has for the reverse process. But for photosynthesis, it's waste. The electrons, though, we'll look at how they operate in the light-dependent reactions. The light-dependent reactions, though, won't happen unless you have a continuous input of energy in the form of sunlight. The energy that was in the sunlight and that doesn't get wasted as heat in the particulars of this get captured in the form of ATP and NADPH. Those reduced carriers get turned back into their low energy versions when that energy is spent by the Calvin cycle. That's why Calvin cycle is spitting out NADP plus and ADP and inorganic phosphate, which then go back to the light dependent reactions and get transformed back into their high energy versions, ATP and NADPH, over and over. So we call the second part the light independent reactions because light isn't a direct requirement. But notice that if light is cut off, then eventually all the ATP and NADPH will be used by this second phase, and it too will stop. But it is independent of light. That's why it's called the light-independent reactions. All right, let's go to 5, talk about electromagnetic radiation, which is what light is. It's energy, electromagnetic energy, meaning that there's an electrical component and a magnetic component. We're not going to get too deeply into this. But there's a duality of nature for electromagnetic radiation, meaning that in some ways it acts as a wave, has wave-like properties, but it also has particle-like properties. It acts like little particles even though they don't have mass. And if you think about it as particles, what do we call a single particle of electromagnetic energy? Anyone know? One particle, so to speak, of light is called a photon. It's a little packet of energy. Now, when you think about it as having wave-like properties, anything with wave-like properties you can describe by wavelengths, for instance. A wavelength can be measured from anywhere on the wave, but as long as you measure from one point to the corresponding point of the pattern when it repeats, that's one wavelength. You could do it right here and right here. That would be the same length. All right? So any given electromagnetic energy has a wavelength. What we see on the top here is the complete spectrum. It's a continuum of electromagnetic radiation that goes through all wavelengths. Very, very short wavelengths on the left here to very, very long wavelengths on the right. All of that stuff is otherwise exactly the same. It's all electromagnetic energy. Just a tiny sliver of this overall range of wavelengths happens to be have this the right wavelengths for it, that stuff to interact with cells in our eyes to send signals to our brain. In other words, only a little bit of this overall range is visible to humans. And that's what we call light. Light is no different from the radio waves that are continuously going through our body or the microwaves. It's all the same stuff, just differing in wavelengths. And the shorter the wavelength, the higher the frequency. The frequency is how many waves pass a stationary point in a given amount of time. So, closer together, that's a shorter wavelength, higher frequency. Also higher energy. And that's why when you get very short wavelengths, that's very dangerous stuff. Gamma rays will kill you. But thankfully, those don't reach us because of the atmosphere. X-rays, dangerous, right? We give low doses to each other to look at our bodies, but X-rays are dangerous. UV is dangerous. That causes skin cancer. But we're getting longer and longer and therefore safer and safer. Radio waves on this end are really long, those 1,000 meters or more for just one wave. And like I said, those are continuously going through our body all the time. We just can't see them. But if the kind of electromagnetic radiation that comes to our bodies is in this range, somewhere between roughly 300 and 400 and 700 nanometers, then we will be able to see it. Now, this is a chapter on plants, not humans. So why does it even matter whether it's visible? Well, it happens to be that plants use pigments that are receptive to roughly the same range of wavelengths in light that our eyes are. Our eyes use different pigments compared to plants. But pigments in general, in chemistry, are things that are able to absorb photons. But each given pigment will absorb photons of a certain wavelength and not other wavelengths. And so this humanly visible range of light also, coincidentally, is the important range for photosynthetic organisms to use. Okay, 6. This is a chloroplast we're looking at. And where you have most of the chloroplasts, depending on the plant species, the greenest part of the plant, like the leaves, looks green because of chlorophyll, which is the pigment used. But We say things all the time like, the leaf is green, as though greenness is actually a property of the leaf. That's not true. Greenness is an event that happens in human brains. It's a perception. It's caused, you know, our brain goes through that process and gives us the feeling, in a sense, of greenness if green light strikes our eyes. But once again, see, I did the same thing. I pretended that the light is green. The light is not green. But when light of a certain wavelength hits our retina, then we experience greenness. Okay? That's happening in our brain. The plant itself is not green. But the reason that it looks green to us is because when you shine white light on it, and white is the combination of all colors, so it has, you know, sunlight isn't just one wavelength. It's many, many different photons, each at a different wavelength. It's a big mixture of wavelengths, all the colors. When those photons strike the plant, a lot of those photons get absorbed by the plant because that's what the chloroplast is trying to do for the purpose of photosynthesis. To receive the energy from sunlight in order to drive photosynthesis to produce sugars, the photons have to be absorbed. That's what gives the plant the energy. Well, when a photon is absorbed, it no longer exists. Now, I told you that a photon is a packet of energy. Of course, the energy still exists because energy can't be created or destroyed. But the photon doesn't exist, and the energy is now in the plant, or in the pigment, I should say. Therefore, if you have white light shining on a plant, the collection of pigments are going to... Those pigment molecules are individually going to absorb photons in the red end and the blue end of the spectrum. The green ones, though, do not get absorbed, or the photons of the green wavelength ranges do not get absorbed by the plant. When a photon, in general, encounters an object, there's three basic possibilities. It can be transmitted, in other words, go right through that object, like through a window. It can be absorbed, in which case it ceases to exist, or it can be reflected, bounced off in another direction. So the white light includes red wavelengths, blue light, red wavelengths, and green wavelengths. The red and blue ones get, those photons get absorbed, no longer exist. The green ones get reflected, and therefore it's like shining just green light into our eyes. That's why the plant looks green. But this means basically that green is not good light to give to a plant. If you're growing something, you would never want to give it just pure green light. That would be basically starving it, because it's not able to absorb that green light, which is why it looks green to us. It'll just reflect it. You have to give it blue and red light. We can kind of see that in slide 7. On this top graph, you have three different, simultaneously plotted, three different curves, which are called absorption spectra, or spectrum for singular. There's three of them, though. One for each of three different categories of pigments. Now, chlorophyll is the principal photosynthetic pigment. But there's actually two major forms of chlorophyll, chlorophyll A and B. They're different from each other, though, and so each one has its own absorption spectrum. The absorption spectrum shows you how well a given pigment does at absorbing different wavelengths. So this is the spectrum of visible light. And notice that chlorophyll A peaks out right here. It really absorbs well in this, for this color. And also pretty well over here. Blue end and red end. But in middle, green, no. That's what I was saying. green light does not get absorbed well, not only by chlorophyll A, but by chlorophyll B either, or by this other trace, which is a different pigment, actually a collection of pigments called carotenoids. Carotenoids are defined as, or they're classified as, accessory pigments because they help the other pigments out by extending the absorption spectrum. If you only had chlorophyll, you wouldn't have this little boost right here that carotenoids give them. But this range right here, all three of them suck at absorbing this, which is why that would kill the plant. You can see the same thing in an action spectrum, which is also shows you a dip on the green range. It has the same X here, even though it wasn't listed again. But an action spectrum is generated, the data for this are generated by measuring how much photosynthesis is actually occurring in response to individual colors of light. And when you give it only green, you don't have very much photosynthesis at all. And on the bottom, this is another way of showing the same thing, except here you have an alga, so this is not a plant, but it's a photosynthetic organism, and several cells are put over the spectrum, so different colors of light are shining on these different cells, and living on these algal cells are bacteria that are aerobic. So the bacteria require oxygen. And if oxygen's not present, then they will not be able to continue to live and divide into more bacteria. Well, there's plenty of oxygen on both ends because the algal cells are producing oxygen as waste product of photosynthesis. And therefore, the bacteria accumulate there. But in the green range, they don't accumulate because there's no oxygen being released by the plant there, or by the alga there. Slide 8 is a picture of chlorophyll. Now, I told you that there's two major kinds, chlorophyll A and chlorophyll B. This actually is both, just depending on what is in this little box. As you see here, if it is CH3, then this whole thing is chlorophyll A. Chlorophyll B is exactly the same, except instead of this one place being a CH3, it's a CHO. But that makes a difference as far as what kind of light is absorbed best by the chlorophyll. Now, I don't want you to memorize this structural formula, but notice that there's really two major parts to this. This green part is the antenna, so to speak. That is the receiving part of this. That's what makes it a pigment. Any given pigment is a pigment simply because it's able to absorb photons. So that's the business end of the molecule as far as photosynthesis is concerned, because if you don't absorb the pigments, you don't get the energy from sunlight. That's the very first requirement. Okay? But then you have the rest of this, and notice that below this part where you still have letters, it's just squiggles and lines, but keep in mind what that means. Every tip or bend is actually a carbon. And then depending on where that carbon is, you have to mentally insert enough hydrogens to satisfy the valence. So this is all, even though there aren't any letters listed here, this is a bunch of carbons and hydrogens. Very similar to a fatty acid, right? Which would be drawn just as a squiggle, because it's nothing but carbons and hydrogens. Well, this has nothing to do with receiving the light, absorbing the photons. But this is a hydrocarbon tail, this part of it, right? Just like a fatty acid is. And therefore, this hydrocarbon tail will have no problem being around the fatty acids that make up the thickness of the membrane in which these chlorophyll molecules are embedded. Namely, the thylakoid membrane. In the chloroplast, remember, you have the thylakoid membrane. Those little green sacs are made out of the thylakoid membrane. And that's where you have many, many copies, millions of copies of chlorophyll. But what keeps them embedded in the membrane, because remember the fluid mosaic model, they're not covalently bonded to each other. What keeps them buoyed in there is the fact that this is a hydrocarbon tail. And so they like being around the fatty acid tails, the phospholipid tails, which are the fatty acid parts of the phospholipids. This part sticks out and is able to receive the photons. Okay, I've got to stop.